Okay. Good morning, everybody. We've just opened up the webinar, so people will come streaming through the doors because they're so delighted to spend half an hour of their time on a Thursday morning listening to what we might have to tell you. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Adrienne. I'm a partner in MPM Legal, which is an employment and business immigration practice based in England. But we work with clients across the world that have a common interest, which is employing people in the UK. I am really pleased to be joined today by my colleague in the immigration team, Victoria Burnip, who is showing up on screen as Peter Beastie, but obviously, very clearly, she is not Peter. You'll be pleased to know that,
just
Vic.
Pretending for today.
Yeah, impostering.
Yes.
Some of you will recognise her from a previous session that we did. And we're also delighted to welcome a guest speaker today, David Udall from Evelyn Partners. Or is it Evelyn Partners, David? Oh, you might have to correct me.
Let me remind myself, it's Evelyn.
Evelyn.
Although I did say Evelyn for quite some time and had to get used to the actual pronunciation.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one. So David, amongst his many other talents, is an expert in international global mobility issues, managing international employees and ensuring organisations are compliant from income tax, social security, payroll, and all those other really scary things that us employment lawyers and business immigration lawyers go, we need an expert on this because we don't know what the answer is. So a very good morning to you both.
Morning. Thank you, Adrienne.
So our session, no problem. We're really pleased to have you. So a session's being recorded as normal, and we host these on our website and our lovely Spotify channel. So if you or your colleagues miss it or want to play it back, then do check them out there. As always, we're happy to answer questions. So if you could pop those in the Q&A function below rather than the chat, but of course you can chat to us too, because that's always lovely. And we will not be turning cameras on or asking you to speak. So feel free to type away and we won't be disclosing who you are. So our theme of this session, as you know, is the future of work, and we're looking particularly today about the issues around remote working. I know for a fact for me this week it's come up in one of the matters that I've dealt with. Today's session is bang on point if our clients' queries have got anything to go by. So if you're offering remote working to your staff, do you know where they're working from? I'll hand over to Vic and David now to take you through some of the pitfalls with some hints and tips to hopefully steer you in the right direction. Over to you guys.
Thanks, Adrienne, and hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to try not to be killjoys and say that you can't do the various nice flexible working arrangements that you might have in force. But we're going to focus today on what we call outbound issues. So where you've got UK companies allowing UK staff members, not necessarily UK nationals, to work from anywhere. And what are the effects on that in terms of employment law rights, immigration? And then I'm going to give all of the scary tax stuff to David to focus on. So we thought we'd just kick off with some trends that we're seeing at the moment. I did a quick search just to see what's going on in the world of recruitment and talent. And I can see there's now a work from anywhere job search engine. So it's part of the Indeed platform, which many of you will probably know about. And if you have a particular wish to be able to work from anywhere, this website now filters through all the jobs that will let you do that, which I think is quite a sea change post-pandemic. And quite an interesting development. And many companies are also advertising work from anywhere or hybrid working or flexible working or a combination of the three as a selling point to attract talent into their businesses. So I think Spotify are doing it, Amex or American Express are doing it. And I guess it's a huge benefit to be able to offer in a world where there's a real talent shortage. And it potentially enables you to avoid the costs of paying for a UK visa. So like I say, we've seen offers ranging from being able to work from home 2 days a week in the UK, 3 days a week. And that could be a holiday home if you're lucky enough to have a villa in Italy, or a digital nomad culture. So that's a very 21st or 22nd century phrase. Or hiring someone in another country to work from their home there without them actually setting foot in the UK. So, with that as the backdrop to modern working arrangements, what do we need to consider? I think from our perspective, the first thing is, what employment rights are you attracting to that relationship when you're allowing someone to potentially work outside the UK? as opposed to working from home in the UK, which I would call flexible working. So for example, the other way around, UK employment law protection can attach to somebody working overseas if there's what's called a sufficiently strong connection between the UK and the employee who's based overseas. So there was a lot of case law about 15 or 20 years ago about people working on oil rigs or in international waters, and which law protected their working arrangements. The flip side has to also be true. Therefore, other countries probably have similar rules. So I understand, again, thanks to my friend Google, because I'm not a French employment law expert, that French law gives more generous holiday entitlement than UK law. And they also can have collective agreements with the unions there, which can be even more generous than the statutory entitlement. And French holiday law can potentially apply if an individual undertakes the majority of their professional work in France, even if they're actually contracted to a UK employer. So going back to your employee who's lucky enough to have a holiday villa in France, if they're spending the majority of their time there, you could be unwittingly, unknowingly incorporating, I think it's at least 5 weeks, if not more, holiday entitlement instead of our more restrictive UK holiday entitlement. And you can't contract out of statutory rights. Courts will generally look at the reality of the situation. So even if you write, well, you will be in France, Mr. Employee, but you won't get any French employment law rights as a result, that's not going to work. It's not going to hold water. So you might find you're in a situation where employees can cherry pick the best of both worlds, regardless of what you state in the employment contract. And clearly, knowing the source of your employment relationship and the law that governs it is critically important for when, hopefully not when, the relationship breaks down. So what we would say is get some local advice. And obviously that could be pricey and complex to administer if you've got a work from anywhere policy and people are choosing where to work in the world. You know, you might need a Vietnamese lawyer, or you might need a French lawyer, you might need an Italian lawyer, all of which will have slightly different rules in their jurisdictions. You've also got to consider other aspects of the working relationship. And you'll be familiar with these anyway, but just as a heads up. So things like health and safety. You won't be inspecting the workplace in Vietnam or France or wherever we are, just to keep picking on those two countries. So you need to do risk assessments. What sort of equipment are your staff using? Have you given them the laptop, the printer, and so on? And are you making sure that actually the working environment they're based in is adequate from a health and safety perspective? And also, I think it's worth looking at remuneration, such as salaries and expenses. What is it appropriate to pay for someone who's traveling into London every day versus someone in the countryside or someone even overseas? If you require them to come to your office once a month, who's going to cover the cost of that? If it's a train fare from Cheltenham, or is it a plane fare from Nice? Should there be a difference? It's just something you're going to have to consider when you're administering these arrangements. From an immigration perspective, it becomes, again, quite tricky. And people fall into two categories. So there'll be UK nationals working overseas. And equally, you might have a non-UK national working in the UK on a visa who wants to spend a significant portion of time back home and working for you from their home country. So if the person is on a visa in the UK, absence from the UK can affect their permanent residency rights, even if they've got the right to work. So to take my fictional French example again, French national on a UK visa, working for more than half the year back home in France, that can affect their rights to permanent residency in due course. So you have to keep an eye on that. And then people outside the UK, what are the rules of the relevant country? So since obviously Brexit, things have changed quite significantly in the EU. There is a hard stop of spending 90 days in any 180 days. No more than 90 days in any 180 days for UK nationals in the EU. And that is across the board in terms of absences. So that's holiday as well as business travel. They are, I hear, very strictly monitoring that at the airports and actually turning people away. So you've got to be aware of what are the limitations of entry into the relevant countries, but also what's permitted there. Not every country has the same rules in the EU as to what permitted business activities can be undertaken on a British passport. It might be meetings and no more than that. And gov.uk has quite a useful page on the different permitted visitor activities in the EU, which you can look up, but it won't be determinative or detailed. And if you actually want people to do their day jobs in other countries, the likelihood is they will need a work visa to actually do that, and a business visitor route won't be permitted. So David, I've now gone through all of the reasons why you should be scared to allow this to happen from an employment perspective, but what about tax, social security, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid to say that it is just as complicated as what you've just talked about. And it's been really, really interesting listening to the obvious overarching statement, which is clients should really get ahead and understand the advice. And the same does apply on the tax side. So I think it's been really interesting watching the trends that have arisen, certainly since the pandemic, because if we go back to before the pandemic, there was really mobility was really driven by business needs. So whether it's short-term or long-term assignments, there was always an attachment to, well, this person needs to work overseas for business purposes. And then, of course, what the pandemic did drive, whether it's in the UK or internationally, was an increase in value of flexible working. And we're at the point now where people are making decisions to stay with employers or move employers because they value flexibility over pay for pretty much the first time in history. And it's really, really important, certainly where people have families, where people have overseas relationships or family overseas, that this flexibility has become really, really important, and how they work and where they work, and whether somebody can just pick up a laptop and work from anywhere is really, really important. The other thing is that obviously for employers, you will get different categories of employers, such as multinationals who will have been used to having a stream of UK outbound and inbound activity, people moving across again for that business purpose, and now having to introduce a new form of mobility and that flexible working. So they already know to an extent what obligations arise, whether it's in the UK or overseas. But the challenge that those people have is, whilst there might be a budget where the multinationals have a budget per person, let's say, where the business costs of mobility are built into their end proposals, it's not the same for flexible working because of that personal choice. So there's a big overarching question: who pays for that? The other challenge, I suppose, really is where it's just the education, where you've got UK domestic businesses that have never had any talent overseas or operations overseas. The pandemic has really driven the education of those businesses starting their global mobility journey. So the second category of profile of employer is where there's been no understanding, and they've just let people work abroad because they want to be that generous employer who wants to retain and attract and have access to that global talent market, but without understanding the obligations.
Yeah.
So in terms of the obligations, when we talk about tax, I mean, we predominantly talk about income tax and corporate tax. And every single jurisdiction, every country around the world, every authority has their own rules in regard to how they tax individuals, but it's generally based on taxable presence. So from a UK perspective, it doesn't actually matter. There's a misconception here, but it doesn't matter if you are UK resident for tax purposes or non-resident. If you're working in the UK physically, you're creating a tax presence here. It's just the difference with a non-resident versus a resident is that non-residents are taxed on their UK income that's sourced from the UK only, rather than their worldwide income, which is what UK residents are taxed on. So let's be consistent and look at the France example. France has become over the years quite a strict country in regard to income tax, social security, and payroll compliance, to the point where if somebody is working overseas in France, creating a taxable presence, the French authorities will want that tax collected. Now, there's two ways to look at this. What's the individual's problem? What's the employer's problem? The issue with what I've just said is that there is a an awkward middle ground where, let's say an individual is allowed to work from France for, I don't know, 10 months of the year, and they're required to be back in the UK for 2 months of the year for meetings, to meet clients or whatever, to just keep in touch, let's say. Well, the French authorities will want their share of income tax. The French authorities will also say that if there is an employer based in the UK, they will want the employer to facilitate the collection of that income tax, which is the equivalent to our payroll pay-as-you-earn rules in the UK. So from 1st of January 2019, the French authorities introduced pay-as-you-earn effectively in France. And what that means is that they will, if there is a non-resident company, but you have an employee in France creating a taxable presence, they will look for that non-resident company to administer payroll locally in France or enlist the help of an intermediary like a payroll agent. So they want their fair share of taxes. Now, if you think back to that example where I said the individual would be working in the UK for 2 months of the year, well, the UK will also want their fair share of taxes. The UK company, again, HMRC, will say, okay, there's a taxable presence here, income tax is due. UK company, you are responsible for facilitating the pay as you earn to us as well. And I think that's where it gets pretty complicated because, again, taking that step back, this situation is now really common. It's not a business-driven need. So who's going to pay for the French payroll administration? Who's going to pay for the UK awkwardness of that payroll administration as well? Well, really, it's down to the employer to facilitate that. And it's really a policy question, who pays for it.
Yeah.
The difference with Social Security is, unlike tax, Social Security, there's an employer and there's an employee side. And Social Security, all it means is it's what we call national insurance in the UK. Well, as there's an employer and an employee side, Social Security is more, it's only payable in one country. And it's driven within the EEA by where the employee liability is. So the good thing is, where you have somebody working in France but still employed from the UK, there's potential to say that you can get something called an A1 certificate or a certificate of coverage to keep that person's remuneration subject to Social Security within the UK. That also means that the employer does not have to register overseas for French Social Security. The reason France is such a good example here, we've got an employer rate of 13.8%, which obviously has been fluctuated because of the health and social care levy in recent months, but it's 13.8% for the employer. That equivalent rate in France is up to 47%.
Ouch.
So if you allow somebody to work in France, but you don't get your ducks in a row, so to speak, in regard to coverage and protecting your Social Security position, not just in respect of the employee, but the employer, the costs of that employment go really sky high by an increase 30% overnight. You add that to the administration that you've got to pay for, and that is pretty expensive to allow that flexibility. So what's the key message, really? Before you allow flexibility, plan ahead and understand what the extent of the costs are. If needed, can you protect some of those costs arising through getting coverage certificates in the UK? On the tax side, can you avoid a taxable presence from that person overseas? And the reason I say that is because the UK has its own tax framework, but also every other country does, as I said from the start. There's also a series of double tax agreements between each country. And if an employer is clever, they can allow flexible working within reason overseas, but use that network of treaties to gain access to short-term exemptions. And what I mean by that is, let's go back to that example of you've allowed person A to work in France for 8 months a year. Well, if you bring that down to less than 183 days in a certain 12-month period, and so long as no costs are recharged, and what I'm hopefully some of the audience is familiar here with what I'm talking about, and it's often referred to as the 183-day rule. There are conditions within the middle of every single tax treaty that follow a certain model. They, cut a long story short, they say that if you meet those conditions and somebody's working in another country, there's no income tax due as a result. An employer can create a policy of flexible working where they can fit that, fit into those parameters. So you can allow a person to work in another country where there is a double taxation agreement and not have any income tax, with the right certificates, not have any social security, and as a result, also exclude yourself from payroll. So that's kind of the I suppose I've gone through what the issue is. What I've just moved on to is how you can best manage this, because really the employer goal is to allow flexibility, but to not create additional admin and unnecessary cost.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance to make, isn't it? And we've had a couple of questions that won't surprise you, David, that's come in while you've been talking. So somebody said, does that mean if an employee works 10 days per quarter in France as personal choice, is there a potential tax liability? I mean, my maths makes that out to be 40 days per 12 months, 10 days per quarter. So I guess that might fall in the 183 days you were mentioning potentially.
Yes, from face value of that, it does sound like it. But just so everyone's aware, I mean, it's actually days of presence rather than work days that 183 day figure accounts for. So in that example, let's say that person has a family in France and they're choosing to do, let's say, 40 days a year back in France. Well, if they're also going back at weekends, that can creep a lot closer to that 183 day. Yeah.
So it's holiday as well.
Work days. Yeah, it's holiday, it's weekends, it's days of presents, it's Easter, Christmas, everything.
All right, I think that also answers the second question then of what if somebody goes back for the summer, spending half of it as a holiday, half of it as work, you've got to look at it as a whole, I think is what we're hearing. We've had a couple of questions about corporate tax liability and creating permanent establishments. If you could give us some nuggets of wisdom there, David, that would be great.
And thank you very much to the person who has raised that, because that is a really important topic. So I've told you about the income tax side. I've told you about how the employer can be responsible for facilitating income tax. So there's also a corporate tax angle, and permanent establishment is a term used by tax authorities around the world to show that where there is somebody working overseas on behalf of a company in the home country, the UK in this case, that whilst there's an income tax presence, that employer can be deemed to have a corporate tax presence in the country of question if there is a fixed place of business arising on behalf of that company. So what the best example I can give when there is a corporate tax presence is where you've got somebody involved, let's say, in revenue generation, involved in sales, CFO, board level, office holder level, somebody who has such responsibility in a company that they have a direct link to the economic success or the P&L of that company. So let's say you've got somebody who is a senior engineer working obviously overseas for an engineering company based in the UK. And they are responsible for closures of contracts with clients, for habitually leading the conclusion of a negotiation. Their signature goes on to the client contract, and they're working overseas in Germany. Well, it's highly likely in that situation that a permanent establishment could arise if that person is working in another country for the benefit of the UK company and procuring those kind of activities in terms of revenue generation. What the impact of that is that host tax authority will say, you've got an extension of your business in our country. We want you to allocate profits that are derived from that person's activity to our country, and we will tax you at our corporate tax rate on that level. Now, a lot of people might find that quite alarming, and it can be alarming because let's say the corporate tax rate in that country is higher than it is in the UK. You are allowed a credit, like you are allowed a credit for income tax purposes when two countries are taxing the same income at once. You're allowed the same credit to be applied on the corporate tax side. But of course, if the corporate tax level is higher than it is in the UK and that overseas country, that's where you've got not just a problem with income tax administration, that person is actually costing you corporate tax profits because of their activity. So again, it comes back to, that's kind of like the worst case scenario. What can you do about it? Well, first off, there is being very aware that there are two levels of employees that you allow mobility for. There's the normal employee who is not going to be involved in what I've talked about, who is going to cause a low permanent establishment risk or no risk. How can you prove that? You need to document that. You need to, when somebody is allowed to work abroad, as you will quite obviously advise on, Victoria, you need to get your employment law aspects quite right, your immigration aspects right. It's best to have that in writing, perhaps through an addendum. What I would advise is that also the duties of whatever that person is doing is also listed in that addendum, and that the evidence that no permanent establishment or a review has been carried out based on that person's role is also in writing. Because if there's an inquiry from the overseas tax office, that's the defence file you need. If there is somebody going abroad and they are obviously going to create a permanent establishment, or it's medium to high risk, let's say, well, question one, can you avoid that happening through changing their duties? That's really, really important. And just so you know, you can't just, on the contract signing point, you can't just get that signed in the UK and that person still plays that leading role. Authorities aren't stupid. They will also know that there's a habitual leadership position from that person, even though you're flicking it back to the UK. You have to extract them entirely from these kind of revenue generating responsibilities. So there's that. Can you change the duties? If you can't change the duties, but you want to allow flexible working, well, yes, you'll have to adhere to corporate tax administration. You need to understand whether there is a incremental increase in corporate tax as a result of this person's activity when there's a credit applied. So in other words, is the corporate tax rate overseas higher than it is in the UK? And then the other thing is, of course, there's a transfer pricing, which is a separate form of tax. There is a transfer pricing mechanism that might need to be considered by that UK organisation that the local tax authority is saying, you need to recharge some of your costs here so we can tax it and subject it to corporate profit. And you have to do that through our local corporate tax return. That's basically worst case scenario. But what I'm saying is, it's not the end of the world. It depends on whether you're paying any more tax as a result of it.
So I think what we're saying is, it's doable, but not without its complexities and potentially its costs. And I guess there's all the administrative headache of all of this as well, leaving aside who pays what and what you're liable for. I mean, yeah. So I think if we can just take our last three minutes, but maybe we'll make it five if people can bear with us for a couple of minutes after 5:30, just in terms of our advice on how to structure this sort of arrangement and then good practice to wrap up. So I think, as David said, I've never actually thought about adding all the duties into the contract. So that's definitely a point for me to take away and to flag up to clients to take some advice on that point, because these days we don't often see a detailed list of duties being incorporated into contracts for employment. And although I said earlier contracts aren't determinative of the issues legally, obviously it sounds like it's the same in the world of tax, careful thought should still be given to the contracts for employment, because if nothing else, it will help to manage the expectations of the employee and put together a clear sort of line as to what is and isn't permitted in terms of the arrangements. Thought in particular should be given to the jurisdiction clauses, although again, they're not determinative, and particularly the location clauses, obviously, depending on what you've agreed with them. I think it needs to also be backed up with really clear policies on flexible or hybrid or working from anywhere arrangements, whatever you're calling it at your organisation. Do you want to factor in limitations? So like David said, do you want to cap that ability to work overseas to 183 days? Although bear in mind, it's not just work, it's also holiday. Do you want to cap it to certain countries? So the EU, which you might find is slightly easier to administer, Or do you want to just say you can only work in countries of which you have the right to work, you're a national, you hold a visa? And then a set process to follow, because it's great having shiny policies and contracts, but if no one's looking after it at your end, it will quickly fall down. So who is handling the working from anywhere arrangements? Do you need a request to be made? Are absences from the UK actually being monitored by anyone? Even if you've written down 183 days, you know, you won't know necessarily where that employee is going on holiday. And then constant monitoring, really, to ensure that the arrangements progress and end as you've agreed. Is there anything you want to add to that, David, from your perspective?
I totally echo what you said in terms of you need to have a policy and be really organised. You need to be able to know where all your employees are when they're working for you. How do you do that? Well, that's where you might have a very clever IT team, much beyond my knowledge, but they can track my IP addresses and things like that. Having an open dialogue with your employees is really, really important, of trust as well. In terms of a policy, I would have an employer and an employee version. So you have a well-educated kind of working group on flexible working, and that's got a bit more detail in as to why this is important and what you need to look out for. For the employee version, it's what you need to know. And again, I would think of a short-term flexible working policy where you can take advantage of those double taxation agreements. In other words, not create that taxable presence overseas, have the do and don'ts of creating a permanent establishment so you're protected. You can say no to people if you think it's too high risk. You know, you should be open with that. It's an approval process. But also where you've got workers that are permanently based overseas, again, having a flexible working policy that obviously includes what employment law and immigration issues arise are, but also just doing your checks and getting advice before, because as an employer, you need to know what you're responsible for. Should you be facilitating income tax through payroll in that country? Should you be paying and registering for foreign social security? Or is there a way for you to protect or keep you and that employee back in UK through obtaining a certificate? It's simply just that education piece for employers and allowing, if you're going to allow that flexibility, I think the overarching message is just know what you're getting into.
Yeah, I think two things that flashed up for me is take the relevant advice, know what you're getting into, and work out how much it's going to cost you, because that's going to be really important to the bottom line. Okay, well, thank you so much, David. That was super interesting, and I learned a lot about that today as well. And that brings us 2 minutes over our finish time, and Adrienne is here to see us off, I think.
Yeah, good timing. I'm well impressed with that. That's really good. Thanks everybody for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed today's session. You already know how to get in touch with us, but David's contact details, if you
want to share his discussion,
will be shared now. And there we go. And that's the way to get in contact with David. We'll be back in 2 weeks to continue on another topic under our theme of the future of work. So if you've missed this or you want to read it again, there's another plug yet again for Spotify and on our website. And feel free to share the love with all of your colleagues and people who you think this might help. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.